revolution. Time for revolution. Hey, it ain't the revolution.
Hello, Winter Park, and welcome to Punkonomics, your weekly talk show that talks about everything underneath the sun and then a lot more. Anyway, today we have a couple of guests, and just to let you know who's behind the mic, my name is Jesse Velez. I co-host the show with Dr. Benjamin Balak, who, by the way, is right here next to me.
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Can you hear me? Okay, and Dr. Balak,
we're ahead of time. We lost all credibility. We're usually late.
All right, Dr. Balak, would you do the introductions for us today?
Okay, well, I'll pass it along in a minute, but we have guests. I've been posting around, anybody who actually follows not just the radio, that there's a showing of a documentary on Rollins campus today. And, well, I've been kind of contacted by a former senior, great student. We'll be embarrassed if I say his name.
Oh, Baruso. Go ahead. No. He's on your panel with you tonight.
Baruso. So he asked me about, am I interested? There's a documentary, and he knows that I use a lot of media, and I like documentaries, and I use them in class a lot. And anyway, I was on vacation, and I said, why not? And things rolled on, and here we are. Tonight it's on, and we'll talk about a bunch of different things, but why don't you start, present yourselves,
okay, thank
your
you.
Company. Then I'm surely to ask you about how you're, how do you get, I'll get there.
We'll go through the questions. So this is really nice to be on your program. Thank you so much, Benny and Jesse. We really appreciate it. My name is Isabella Johnston, and my business partner is Tony Cowan, and we're both here in the room with you guys. We are the owners of 3P Business Consulting, and we use a lot of interns. They come from Rollins, and so that's one of the drawings. Right. And Bernardo is an intern with our company, and that's why he reached out to you. So a little bit of history about who we are is we are a full scope of services for businesses, primarily startups and entrepreneurial types. We provide everything from legal to accounting to marketing, behind the scenes type of services too, mm-hmm. whether it's systems, HR systems. And we get our interns from a lot of schools. Mostly, many of them come from Rollins, and they are
the best. I'm going to definitely be very interested in this kind of model of doing business here,
They are the best ones. They are really, really good. But Barry Law School, UCF, Valencia Full Sail, they come from many of the schools. But, I graduated from Rollins. I worked here at Rollins. I was in the Foundation Relations Department. I wrote grants for the college for many of the things on the campus, for the day program, and also Alphondin. I helped run that project too, Annie Russell. So, and then I taught entrepreneurship for 2 years here at the college for the whole school. So I have deep roots with Rollins and love it very, very much. And that's why, it's very important to me to always be able to align our company with things that the campus does, because I want to support the campus. And so one of the things that we do is also we look to see how we can market in different ways and really provide a community service through an educational realm. And so we started doing these quarterly movies where it's an outreach into the community. So I'm going to let Tony go ahead and introduce himself now so people can hear a little bit more about him.
Hey, so I met Isabella a little over 2 years ago. And when she told me her concept for a consulting company that utilizes an internship program, what I heard was an opportunity to generate a human capital engine. And human capital is so important with ventures today. Good ideas usually don't get off the ground without a lot of different input. And I think one of the magical pieces of what we do at 3P is we give interns an opportunity for real life experience. So
not just gophers making coffee.
Right.
I hear them complain.
My internship was
you.
In a basement answering a telephone with no supervision. Yeah. Right. So, it's really exciting when you see people who have, toiled through achieving an education actually get the chance to take that and play with it. And I can sit down with our interns and say something like, okay, I need you to design a sales and marketing strategy for this product and show me what you got. And they get to do it. Mm-hmm. And when it's done, they get to implement that. And it's the same for our graphic artists. You know, they come out of school and they get to design graphic arts and logos and branding for real companies and drive down iDrive and point, see that logo? That's mine. I did that.
The most important aspect of the balance of this internship is that it always has the academic oversight that's really required of any type of an intern opportunity. So for me, I've been teaching adult learners for 10 years now, and then also a throwback to the public schools. So education is in me, along with nonprofit, and then I approach small business consulting as an opportunity to educate others. So this internship with us always has that academic component as the primary part of it.
You have to train them, after all, because absolutely. There's the school schooling, and then there's the real world experience.
So I sit down with them, and we find out what are the goals that they want to be able to achieve, and we work to, you know, really make sure that they can own things that will be going on their resume. Mm. And so that's why when they get to do anything with our company, whether it's really reacting directly with our clients, it's always with that academic type of oversight that's provided. And that's with myself and with Tony. My background is, you know, like I said earlier, I have a BA in English from Rollins. My MBA came from a competing school. And then I'm all but dissertation for a PhD in leadership with a specialization in human resource development. So when Tony and I had sat down and we were talking, for me, I had seen that primarily most of a business's budget will be 50% the human side, you know, the human capital that he mentioned earlier. So that's really one of the biggest assets that we can bring to any of our clients. And it really helps the interns, too, because they get to have real, real experience.
How long do they stay? I mean,
usually 3 months.
I mean, but unpaid, right?
Yeah, it's an unpaid internship.
And do you hire out of them?
Yes. And we actually have promoted from within, and so they are on. We're all on commission type basis right now, but yes.
So it's not just the two of you, though.
No, we have actually 1, 2, 3, 4. We have 4 people with us now.
Okay. Uh-huh, yeah. Uh-huh. And then how many interns?
20. We've had up to 23, so I know how many I can actually manage. It's the same as a classroom. And for you, I know that you guys can relate to this, because to have 25, 40, I mean, when I was teaching in the projects, I've had up to 40 students in a room. So can you manage them? Yeah. And, you know, those
people.
But
there's a cost, too.
Yeah, it doesn't. But the ones that want to intern in our company, it's always an opportunity to be able to, again, gain real, real experience, but with always the oversight that's really required. Even anybody that comes in from the law school, they have weekly meetings with our attorney, so that, because by law, only an attorney can supervise, you know, anybody that's going to law school. So they always get
that
oversight.
Suffer through the bar, right?
Yeah.
To get something.
It's
for
always
it, right?
Really hard.
Poor things.
Yeah.
We really feel bad for the lawyers.
So anyway, that's the internship program there.
All right. Yeah, and I know I'm familiar. Students always ask me, and I say, I know nothing about it. You know, I'm an academic. What are you asking me for? But we have people that do, and probably, you know, direct you. You're probably on their list.
Oh, yeah. When we've gone to the Career Expo over here at Rollins for the past 2 years, we have a line. And we, you know, like 40 people will be in line to come and intern with us. And that's a huge compliment. We really appreciate those accolades.
Yeah, I even heard when I started posting a couple of things, I mean, I heard a couple of students were saying, like, hey, I interned with them, or I want to intern with them. So you're obviously, you know, popular.
Super nice to hear. So we have this event that we're doing tonight, and it's called Money for Nothing, A Look Inside the Federal Reserve, all about economics.
Yeah. We'll talk a little bit about that, definitely. Well, maybe a lot, who knows. But before, how would you do, so you, where do you come up with, what's your connection to this documentary all of a sudden? Because that was all of a sudden, I was, wait a minute, what do they have to do with documentary? Were you consulting them? I mean...
Oh, no. When I go through a list, that there's a company, it's called TUG, and they have a list
Thug?
Of... T-U-G-G,
nice.
TUG, yeah.
TUG.
And they have a list of movies that people can, you know, peruse through and pick to use for hosting the movies. This director was wanting to get his message out there. So it's a documentary, and spoke directly with the director, and he's a really great guy. Just wanting to make sure people understand what's going on inside the Fed, and that was part of the message. for us on this side of the table, we see it as an opportunity to be able to provide a community outreach, build some relationships within the community, within the academic institutions also. Economics is a key factor that weighs into every business aspect that we have, so it's really important to be able to be aware that there's always vaccine information that's going on.
And economics is a problematic field, too, because on so many levels, we're really sick.
One of the things that most impressed me about this documentary was how non-political it was.
True, absolutely. I was going to say, in the world, right. Yeah.
It's so rare to see something that's not just another version of Hot Potato and what party gets left holding the bag for the problem. And this documentary really does a great job of just, this is the history of the situation, these are the accountabilities of those involved, and here's what we're dealt with as a nation. That's what impressed me more than anything.
Yeah, I agree. It's rare. It's really rare, especially actually the whole Federal Reserve conspiracy is a cottage industry, I would call it.
Yeah, right.
Literally, some of them are highly entertaining. I enjoy them. I assign them in my media and propaganda class, but this one definitely struck me as pretty balanced. I have my criticism, but that's not a bad thing. One of the things we teach in school sometimes that you don't have to agree with everything to think it's good. But I absolutely concur that it's a kind of a centrist, nonpartisan. Let me say, my criticism is they're missing things. It's not with what they talk about, and it's perfectly legitimate for the director to say, "Well, I had to keep it manageable."
Right.
So the reason why I picked it is I really felt like it was going to be a key component to being able to tie business and some of the educational theories that are, taught here at Rollins, but certainly at many of the other schools where our interns come from. And we'll just want to make sure that anybody in the Rollins community, if they show their ID, they get to come in free tonight.
Bring your R card. Right?
Yes, bring your R card.
Even if it's expired, it's probably worth it.
Yeah. We'll let you in.
I'm a bit of a white hat hacker,
And so everybody needs to know where it is, right? So it's at Bush Auditorium.
Bush Auditorium, right, 7 p.m.
Now, we are doing a little bit of a networking event, 5:30 to 6:30, and that's over at Mitchell's. But then we're all moving over here to the campus, and it's going to be the movie and then Q&A, and you are the moderator on that.
I'm a moderator now?
Oh, my gosh, yeah. You didn't know that? You've just been promoted.
What? Me? Moderate?
You're overseeing it all.
Moderate is not in my vocabulary.
Yeah. The anarchist moderator.
Seriously. I thought it was just on the panel. I just get to...
Yeah, but you're on the panel, but you're the head of it. So.
You could be Judge Benny.
Grumble, Yeah, Judge Benny, I can do that. That could be funny, actually. Economic court,
Right.
We need to work on that idea. Hey, I can see that. It's going to have to be MA rated.
Right,
of course. For excessive violence. No sex, just violence when it comes to that. Absolutely. I can probably handle. I mean, I chair sessions and conferences. I don't know. Sometimes you have that professor that just keeps talking and talking, no matter how many cards you flash at him. But
you'll be able to keep everybody on point, I'm sure. So.
Yeah, right. We said it'll be all, and we'll do a lot of Q&A, right? That's the idea. No big couple of minutes each, and then we just open it up and take it from there, type of thing.
Yeah.
Sounds perfectly anarchic enough that I can handle.
Yeah. So you shared it with your students, I'm sure, right?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Certainly, very some nice. Of them will come. I don't know. You know how it is. Sometimes they intend to, but then they have better things to do. But I'm giving credit for it, even.
There you go. That's always an enticement.
You have to. We can't pretend. I mean, it's one of the things sometimes in the education system that bugs me, and I think students really feel it, and I recognize it that if we are going to have a system for pay, basically, we pay for work with credit, then we can't then expect them to do things for the love. Because this is not a system of love, This is a system of payment. And there's all bits of that duplicitous attitude where, they only do it because it's on the test. I mean, what do you expect? If you don't want them to do it because it's on the test, don't give tests. Simple. Right?
I hear you're very popular among many of the students out there. They come back and they tell me you're one of their favorite professors because you do challenge them.
Yeah, I try. I mean, I try and make it, fun but challenging. But, and I'm honest about not succeeding because I'm always experimenting, and therefore there's a lot of things that go wrong all the time. Like this weekend, there was a whole crash of my gamified system. A few software engineers didn't didn't do anything in Indiana in a startup company. Had a really rough weekend, but we're more or less back online. But my students were sending messages, oh, I can't access my thing, I can't access that. And I was all take a deep breath, relax, you know.
Now, I know that Tony's going to want to be able to hear more about that because he has a little bit of experience in the gaming field, too.
Ooh.
So you guys...
Well, my experience is in gaming, not in the field. Yeah. I'll admit that, you know, business, I wouldn't, you know, I have no clue. I have a few things. I have an anti-business skill. You know, I think I can... Mm. I can't, you know, really. I mean, if I think it's a good idea, don't invest in it.
Oh, you know? I got you. I understand.
If I think like,
it would be the brown no thumb for business, is what you're saying.
Type of thing, right?
Yeah,
similar with
thumb.
Plants too. My wife does the planting. I just kill. That's what I do. I do gardening, but it's always
but you know,
cutting it off.
You open up a Pandora's box. So why don't you tell the public what the gaming system is all about?
Mm. Okay, and that's kind of a little bit, you know, I like the, I can even segue, because what you're providing in some sense is after school experience, or during school experiential learning,
mm-hmm.
where you actually, in some sense, you could see it as a game too, you know, you're playing it being a professional, not quite yet, but hopefully
very
in the future.
Very true, exactly.
And that's right. I mean, I'm sure if somebody screws up seriously, you're going to have to give them a little bit of a talk and maybe even... kick them out, so it's not no risk. Play essentially the big characters of play is that when you screw up, you just start again until you get it right.
It's a learning environment.
But there are screw ups and there are screw ups, of course. There are things that are pretty bad and things that are a learning opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, if you're asking, Jesse, so what for a while now, for now over 10 years, I can say I had this insight. Along with a few other people out there, surely, most of which I know, it's still pretty small, that when we do our homework on education, you know, they don't really teach you how to teach in graduate school.
No.
Rarely. I was actually in Carolina, UNC, Chapel Hill. That's you know, let me give, don't care much about the basketball, but the graduate library kicks butt. Though when I was there, I couldn't say it or I'd be beaten up. But seriously now... they did teach us a little bit, but not that much. And when you get on the job, especially in a liberal arts college, it gets really, you know, very difficult to figure out how to do it right by yourself. So it becomes informal. You know, if you've got good elder colleagues like I had, you know, they hook you up with some advice. Doing a little bit of reading and thinking about things that were intuitive for me first, and I was a good teacher in graduate school, won an award, etc. So I had the intuition, I suppose, and I loved it, especially where it comes from, being good at it, typically. I realized that how we do it in schools is not how pedagogy, how the experts think we should be doing it mm-hmm. for the past, you know, most famously since Benjamin Bloom's... pyramid levels of learning is the very famous 1956 book. Let alone issues of different learning styles and you know, let me stop here. If it comes around, we can go on. There's so many things we just do wrong. We do in the worst possible way. But my insight came from the fact that I'm kind of first generation gamer, where it is a badge. I played Star Trek on a mainframe computer in 1975 with a printer. Didn't even have a screen.
Oh,
every
wow.
time a new texted print came out, you know, that's the oldest, the first, you know, the gamers will know from documentaries, you know, back in the days where the men were, when the men were made of, no, when the ships were made of wood and the men of iron. Yeah.
Okay, so I want to ask you a question. Did you have Star Trek uniforms or costumes that you would dress into?
The first thing, it was 66, 67, 68, you know, when I discovered it, I was, you know, 3-4 years old.
Uh-huh.
I did at some point in my life have a pajama as a child. But I will admit that I never was in, you know, I saw that as a weird American phenomenon before coming to America in 93, this whole convention and stuff. Not belittling or anything, but it just seemed kind of weird from the outside. Since having kids in America, though, I'm a regular in MegaCon. they won the children's costume. You know, my wife and me had 2 PhDs, spent 2 weeks doing nothing but sewing, you know, blood elf costumes for 10-year-olds, you know.
And, that is so cool,
and it's
though.
Cool. Oh, yeah. I'm like Mother Superior. I walk there, you know, with the kids behind me, you know. I even dress weird myself.
That's good, though.
Though it's not what it used to be. It's actually been a little bit. Last year, I was disappointed. Too full, above all. Just too many people. Can't handle the numbers. It was really uncomfortable, frankly. Okay, so yeah. So that's weird, but one of the things that I find, you know, the whole, that's the geekdom, right? The whole culture of the outsider, which is in many ways, maybe some, in some sense, it's not the mainstream when you look at the media, right, of the plastified celebrities and such. But there are a lot of them out there.
Yeah, right. It's like, where did all these normal people come to my nerd event?
Right. Yeah, exactly. And they're dominating the good schools in some sense. Though, let us go back to our roots in this show. What mostly dominates the good school are rich kids. Just saw the numbers recently, you know. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, no, if you're bottom 40, you're not going to any college that's worth its time. Forget it. You know, yeah. You're the underclass. It's all hype. And this is a big problem. So anyway, I said to myself, I know a place where the principles of good education, engagement, experiential, flexible, good teaching, that the best teachers, those we remember, those who inspire us, manage to do somehow in their classrooms, no matter how big they were or whatever, right? That good, those good teachers that made us care. There's a place where they do it regularly, and that's the gaming industry.
Yeah,
that is why I like
I'm
to
really
play.
I'm really impressed because, you know, I studied Gary Gygax gaming rules, mm-hmm. and I was playing Dungeons & Dragons mm-hmm. in the 70s.
No.
And so I grew up in a gaming culture mm-hmm. Way before gaming was cool.
Oh, yeah, 70s definitely.
So, so what I discovered in gaming is that I could learn an entire player's handbook of spells in moments mm-hmm. and then I would go to school, and I could not remember for the life of me when Napoleon conquered right. what city, right? Yeah. It was just not the same thing. And so I immediately, at a young age, discovered that gaming is learning. Mm. Play is where you learn. So when you were talking about you fail a lot because you create these games and then they fall apart, well, I learn more from my fall-apart games mm-hmm. than ever from my structured victory.
Right.
Right? Because the structured victories, as rare as they are, because they were structured, you really didn't learn anything. You already knew that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the debriefing,
it.
That what happened, what went wrong.
That's right.
That's actually what my kids do at homework in the Economics and Historical Perspectives, one of our core courses. They read or watch documentaries about real history, and then they compare it to the virtual history that came up in the game of civilization is what I've been using for 10 years now. And
Sid
that
Myers?
Kind of dynamic. Yep.
Yeah.
Civ 5 now.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's brilliant.
That's what I was playing when you came over the other day.
Oh, okay, I know.
I have like we have a gaming room, a guest room. Actually, we don't have a lot of guests because we're too busy gaming, so go away. But we have a room. We put the double air conditioning in it, and we have, you know, three gaming rigs.
Nice.
And because I have two kids, I'm 17.
Well, that's
and one,
actually smart
12.
Because anybody that's going to be a guest in your house, they're probably sleeping on the couch, and they will leave really soon.
Yeah, well, they probably get. I mean, if we want to be dark, they'll probably get cancer from all the electromagnetics going on in that room. Yeah, we have an ongoing argument about trying to ban tablets and such from the bedrooms of the kids. That it's a difficult struggle. I'm torn. You know, yeah, it's probably smart, but then who am I to deprive? You know, media for my children. I mean, in my attitude, that's just child abuse almost, right?
Right.
So, but yeah, you're bang on. I mean, in fact, the real holy grail, and I've been talking with people about it and talking with my son, who's often a regular, Felix is often a regular guest, but I think he's dog sitting right now. So if he's listening, yo. Is to get that element, how can you geek out on the class? Right, precisely what you discover, where gamers have this remarkable amount of knowledge. Now, if they could know a little bit less about the precise epic gear for the raid and just apply a fraction of that to real world. So with my son, actually, as we were touring Italy, as the regulars know, in the summer, we had at some point when the girls couldn't take the heat and the anymore, we went, all just him and me, we went to the baths of Caracalla, which is one of the coolest ruins in Rome. And for about 4 hours, we were intensely talking about how do we make, as we were walking through this amazing building, it kind of felt virtual reality. You know, it felt like, how could we play this? How could we make a game like the World of Warcraft? But it's real history. How could we make it real? And we really went through, as you were saying, a lot of the things that we got to was not really outlining how that could ever happen with even a limited budget, but how it's impossible. the impossibilities on so many levels, you know? So we talked about how all these technology trees in these games are just wrong. Technology doesn't work like that.
Right.
Could we make it work right? It's much less organized, much less, you know, Civ is often referred to games like that as a god game, right? Because you're the god.
You know, it's interesting because when I was running a company called PlayMotion out of Atlanta, we met with a group that was recording the antiquities. And they had a 3D camera, and they came to us because we had a computer vision technology that allowed the computer to see, and we had real high-level motion sensor devices way back in the 90s.
To render stuff into a 3D model, a real
world
into 3D.
Well, it could. Our technology was more about gaming. One of our installations was at Epcot Soarin' before you go on the ride, and you do the crowd moves. Our system could see the crowd moving, so you pop the balls. That was a PlayMotion installation.
Okay.
But they... Interesting to what you were saying was they have taken on cataloging all of the antiquities. So in a 3D model, so literally the grains of sand that have popped out of this statue from 3,000 years ago is captured in a 3D rendering. So when you speak of creating a game that's historically based, a lot of the digital data for materials already exist.
It's more of the structure, actually. You know, that's true. I mean, just even Google Earth and things like that. I mean, it's wonderful when you have you can put ancient maps, which is I love ancient maps, right? And you can superimpose them. Nothing. You can spend the whole day looking at London and going through the current satellite image and go back to the Middle Ages.
Yeah,
and see the map superimposed. It's fascinating.
Civ is great because it reminds me of the old documentary, the BBC documentary Connections.
And
when you look at how you evolve through technology, it reminds me of that sort of narration of how we created refrigeration. And if it wasn't for X that happened 2,000 years ago in a coincidence,
we wouldn't have that
today.
Exactly.
Right? So Civ sort of enhances that. But you're right. There's also the one has nothing to do with the other, right? You can't...
Or just the rigidity of it, fact that you just, okay, you develop that, and then you develop this, and it's not like that, that you decide what you're developing next.
Yeah.
You know, you don't really know what the great next invention is. It's not like you spend all the capital to develop industrialization. It happens due to
Well, as consultants, we like to pretend we can.
Well, right, a lot of pretending. Talk about economists, that all these Ivy League guys, who predict the future.
Right.
Wrong. Every time, but they still get a bonus, sort of like bankers, right?
Right.
You know?
That's right. Too big to fail.
But you're just mentioning connections. I have them all. Are they even available? I don't know. Whoops, shouldn't say that. But they're brilliant. That's one of the most amazing. It's an education on itself, precisely. And James Burke is like a major historian of science, and in so many ways, back in the 70s already. One of the things I remember still gives me goosebumps just to think. One of the first times I started really thinking seriously about political economy is from him. At the end of Connection, he talks about the fact that as the world gets so complicated and complex, not only just the machines that we can't fix, right? I mean, if it breaks down, we don't know. The vast majority of us don't know what to do about it. But also even thinking about understanding the world, how does trade flow? How does the Federal Reserve System work? How does that tie into global finance? How does it tie into the real economy, which is my thunder. That's my biggest peeve with the documentary. It doesn't talk about the connection with the real economy. Mm-hmm. And that's a miss, I think. It should have, hey, nobody's perfect, right? But all those complications... And most of us don't understand at all what's going on. And in fact, that opens then the door to people to manipulate us about what's going on. And at the same time, and that undermines what Burke was saying that really kind of scared me back then already, that undermines the possibility of democracy. I mean, the citizenship doesn't understand the world in which it lives, then at best it becomes a kind of a sham system by which they get manipulated and vote. So you have the vote, but and that brings us to where we are today, where we have, I like to compare, I think it was Sandy who launched that in our discussion. So let's give Sandy Davies, we should bring back one of these days, the joke that in our banter that we have a democracy about as much as East Germany under communism. Right, the differences in some ways between the different factions, often in the days of the 70s, the darkest days of communism, right? I mean, that you had the reforming factions that eventually led to the Perestroika, Glasnost, and, didn't work out that well, but still. And the openness and reforms. And you had the hardliners. the differences between those two groups within the Communist Party, for which 96% of the population voted and the others were sick or couldn't make it or something, right? One party system. The difference there were pretty much not dissimilar to the difference between the Democrats and the Republicans here, to whom 96% of the population votes.
Right.
And I consider, I think that things will get worse and worse until that is broken. But
well, it is a one-party system. I mean, anywhere you put it.
There are some state initiatives that are poking at this. There's some movements like Lawrence Lessig is doing a lot of work on that. We need a constitutional. I'm no expert. Yeah, I'm following at a non-professional level here. I mean, I see how the market system is dying in front of us. Killed by those who sing its praises the most, you know, history it'll be a very funny chapter, funny in a kind of a horrible, dark, sadistic sort of way. But anyway, I see that side, but there are people doing something about it. So I really think, and I think there's also some more openness to it. There used to be, you're either Democrat or you're Republican, and if you think the Democrats are jokers, then you have to reform the party from the inside, make it more progressive. If you think you're kind of libertarian, you think the Republicans are sellouts, then you have to push them to purity from within. No, no.
You know, what I have noticed over time is that in the what I call one-party system, you have the Republicans who come up with all these laws, you know, either pro-business or against the
pro
middle
big
class,
business,
pro big,
yeah, pro donating,
definitely.
Business.
and then the Democrats get in, and what they do is they actually enforce these laws that the Republicans pass, and then the whole term they try to either dilute it or get rid of it, and then there goes the term, and basically what they're doing is just passing the ball to each other. You know, it's almost like, okay, I'll take the blame for the next 4 years, and then you can take it the next 4 years. In the meantime, all friends make money.
Right.
I mean, how,
it's like a Punch and Judy show while behind
good
the same
cop,
people
good,
are running the show.
It's really good. If you think about it, it's really almost like a good cop, bad cop.
Yeah.
You know, for both sides.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, it works. You know, it's a.
Of course, it's very
it
systematic,
well.
You know, and I'm sure they hire up people like myself that are into organizational behavior, you know, for corporations and stuff like that to tweak it better to keep the employees in line, and consequently most corporations, I don't know about now if they still do it, but back when I was in the airline industry, our corporation, our airline, basically gave you the inclination of where to vote or who to vote with by saying, okay, these are the folks that are going to take away your benefits or your pension or
so
whatnot.
So there was some kind of a flyer that they gave you and said, here, we encourage you to vote
no,
this
No, the
direction?
Way they would do it, the way they would do it is through the union and through the managers. The union reps would say, well, you got to say no to this, you know, because this is at stake, but they wouldn't give you the whole picture.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it actually, when you lose those benefits or you gain them, depending on, you know, which side they would stand, then you would go like, oh, okay, well, what about these other issues? Now we got a big mess.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mostly like Teamsters, I guess I can say that Teamsters supposedly are very pro Democratic Party. Well, I've met quite a few Teamsters representatives that are nothing but complete right-wing, you know, and they really are not thinking about the employees. They're thinking about the union and the company. The employees come in last, usually. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times what I saw in 20 years, a manipulation of political beliefs, manipulation of job description, okay, for cost effectiveness, and in many ways isolating that sector of the public to just think a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that translates to politics, just about everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but every group has their own agenda, so.
Of course. But when you have the small people at the top, you know, pretty much feeding down all the programming to everybody else, what you have is the
well, it's
worker
run
drones.
By bureaucrats, too. I mean,
right.
Actually, again, it's another parallel to how it was in the old communist countries. These guys you describe are apparatchiks. They used to call them, you know. They just work the system. They don't care. They aggrandize themselves. And
mm-hmm.
Remember, I mean, it's an important, I think, insight today in understanding some of the problems that America's facing is that, you know, we all were taught that, you know, old communist countries were all centralized, inefficient, and it's true. There was an overbearing, heavy, corrupt bureaucracy running everything, and they were just as much a 1% or 6%, I think, members of the Communist Party. But again, the top people who went abroad and had foreign currency and lived the good life, despite being the leaders of a communist country. But it's not just because it's public, because the government, the public sector is running this giant, bloated, corrupt bureaucracy. In America, we have ourselves a private, for-profit, giant, bloated, corrupt bureaucracy. So, you know, they're behaving in very similar ways. So the problem is the centralization. Okay, my anarchist colors are showing, but it's not politics. It's
right. It's reality.
It's common sense.
It goes back to that human psychology of prison guards are prison guards.
Right.
And prisoners are prisoners. And if you call it dictatorship or you call it democracy, the prison guards are the prison guards. And they're going to behave
right,
like
Stanford,
that.
Right, Stanford experiment.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, basically what I was saying earlier, I mean, people, you know, I can tell you of executives who you thought would be like very pro-business and doing tons of negotiation. They were the ones actually rooting for the employees. So, you know, you just don't know.
Something buzzing. All those many devices around us.
I know. We're pretty much trapped with technology here. But mm-hmm. No, I mean, basically what you would see is that you know, people that from that you would least expect that would be rooting for the employee, you know, would come out and say, well, you know, how about if we do this? And then you would have the union say, oh, no, we don't want that because that's your idea. You know,
yeah,
but then when it all boils down to it, then you look up and go like, well, how do we get here? This is not even what management was offering. And this is not even what the union was offering. This is something that's not even going to benefit us.
Yeah.
And, you know, unfortunately, because of the mob type mentality, that's what you get.
I think that's why social entrepreneurialism is so important. I think that social entrepreneurialism is creating an entire infrastructure where business that is for profit can solve problems for society
mm-hmm.
because their focus is on solving problems for society, not necessarily a bottom line for investors.
Right.
And
right.
Yeah, I mean, I'll admit to you, I'm a bit skeptic.
You know, and skeptic. I was getting ready to say
how to
something
make it
skeptical
work.
About it.
Here's, well, as we... actually had a client that entered the social entrepreneurial competition and won it in a venture competition because the foundation of that company is about creating emergency response solutions.
Mm-hmm.
And it could very easily be a nonprofit company, but if it's a nonprofit company, then it has to rely on donations. But as a for-profit company, it can rely on generating its own revenue stream to stand itself up and be self-reliant. Which part of the problems with some nonprofits is because they rely on contributions and grants, mm-hmm, especially mm-hmm. in a down economy, mm-hmm. they're not self-sufficient. They're okay. almost as helpless as the people they're trying to help.
Who do they sell to? That sounds like stuff that the
FEMA,
know, local government, yeah, government,
yeah, municipalities. Mm-hmm. A lot of the.
I do have a concern. Hmm. Okay, and I'm sure Benny was going to go at it. But I do appreciate the whole concept of entrepreneurship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I haven't graduated from here. Of course, I'm in the job market and the whole bit. And, you know, it's fine to offer experience. But at the same time, what I've seen out there and what I get from students that went to Rollins with me and my former university, they're all saying, well, okay, I graduated, blah, 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 and I have some experience, but the only jobs available out there are entrepreneurships where they're offering internships, okay? Now, with the internship, I mean, and this is, of course, it depends on the company, okay? You have companies who are doing internships who are actually getting these people, training them the whole bit, but they're not really giving them the possibility that they're going to be hired. And a lot of these people that I've spoken to have been bouncing from one company to another, and they're all saying, well, they're getting work for free, basically.
Yeah, there is
a movement in Congress right now to stop that,
yeah.
Because corporations are abusing something that, to me, is a really good idea.
And there's already precedent for that. TriStar Films was sued and lost for the way they treated their interns. Mm. They were taking on internships. They were providing no educational guidance whatsoever. Right. They were giving them jobs that were for pay positions, but they were filling them in with free interns.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And the interns gathered together and sued them. So there is case law that supports.
Right.
There's rampant fraud
labor
in many, many sectors.
Absolutely.
In fact, that's my second primary concern with the movie. Again, mm-hmm. not their focus, yet I think it's important to realize there is the mismanagement of the economy by the Fed, as that they do a very good job explaining. But how about the rampant fraud, which is a major player too?
Yeah. Right.
So, yeah, like private education for profit, for example, a lot of times. There's tremendous, like, it's awful. They entrap people in debt and provide a third-rate education, which guarantees no employment, and it's covered by the federal guarantee.
Some of the schools aren't even accredited.
I know
that there's some schools where the students where I've been teaching, they found out, oh, my gosh, this program isn't even accredited. Mm. The school will be, but the program isn't yet.
Yeah.
And now they aren't even able to get a job.
And it's a very precarious situation for the job seeker out there, because when you see all these internships, you know, for me as a student, I do have different interests. Like, let's say if WPRK had an internship and, you know, right away we'll go like, oh, okay, well, maybe there's something I should consider. But, you know, basically for what I've seen, at least for what I'm told from friends that have gone to these other internships at these companies, is that you really do not have a guaranteed period, you know. Mm-hmm. And they use them up for 6-8 months at a time, and then bye-bye.
Yeah, and given that the situation is desperate out there in the job market, that allows to predate on desperate people. That's kind of an old principle. When people are desperate, there will be those who will predate upon them. And that's really kind of, you know, they're good. Like, we go back to social entrepreneurship. I mean, there's good people coming up with good ideas on how you fund them. You know, there's many creative ways. That's wonderful. But maybe the most famous one, and I'm used to it from class, because a lot of students are interested in you know, doing good. And so they quickly come to look at microcredit, popular topic for senior seminar. And there's a lot of buzz about it, but then you have to be critical about things. So even Muhammad Yunus himself, who kind of invented it, today says that, you know, the vast majority of the microcredit industry is predatory financial fraud on the poor. It's just like, oh, we've already taken everything from the middle class. Is there any flesh we can pick off the desperately poor? So, again, it's a great idea. It can work fine. And the difficulty is where we should be arguing about is, so how do we make it work? How do we create the environment, the system that doesn't allow it to turn into a fraud? And it's a difficult question, because, you know, your liberal knee-jerk reaction will be regulated. My answer to that is, I call it the liberal fallacy. I'm an equal, we're committed to equal opportunity hate. You don't know the show, so just say. Yeah.
Both sides are screwed up.
And it comes very natural to me. He's a bit of a liberal.
I have my days.
No, you know, I mean, it depends. And sometimes I am that, sometimes I'm the other. But seriously, I call it the liberal fallacy, because it's the notion that, sure, government, if we could import the government of Norway to regulate in America, we'd probably be in pretty good shape. Yeah. You know, think of Iceland. Their economy was a paradigm catastrophe in 2008. The difference is they didn't bail out their bankers. They arrested them.
Right.
You know, that's the key difference. They are totally on their way, doing great. They have some other advantages. Fine, you know, so it's not all their decisions. But yeah. While in France, the Prime Minister Hollande just fired his cabinet because they preposterously suggested something in America would never happen, that maybe they should actually at least pretend to fulfill their election promises and not entirely backstab the population and do what the bankers tell them. So the Prime Minister didn't appreciate that idea, and they fired fired his cabinet, certainly especially the Minister of Industry, that said that maybe we should lay down with the austerity a little bit because we promised not to.
Well, you got to learn from the makers of the guillotine, right?
Yeah, here the Democrats have absolutely no shame. You know? It's like, you know, let's see, is there anything we haven't violated of our promises? You know, nope. But yeah, so anyway, senior moment there. The liberal fallacy is the notion that, sure, good regulation would work. A good government is necessary for a functioning country, certainly a capitalist market system, absolutely, but you need a good government. The conservative fallacy is the notion that you can live without one. Mm. And then the most powerful companies, the richest people, will just rule. No government will be like pre-capitalist era, pre-rule of law. It will be really where a noble can just look at some peasant and doesn't like the way he looks and runs him through with a sword. We're getting there. And so maybe not the sword yet, but economically, yeah, you know. So, you know, I destroyed my company. Let's just go Chapter 11, raid the pension funds. That's theft, you know. Right. And the government is there to enact the law that allows that theft.
And it's a matter of who's watching who, because I developed ambulatory surgery centers for 10 years and supported with the regulatory compliance, state licensure, Medicare mm-hmm. certification, accreditation. And when the government oversees something like that, it is good for industry. It's good for the consumer. It's good for the industry to maintain standards. But then when the government is responsible for maintaining its own standards in the VA, mm-hmm. how can you be responsible for managing yourself in such a situation? And that's a catastrophe. It's why I don't want the government being the people who pick up my trash. I don't want my city government picking up my trash. I don't want my state government picking up my trash. I don't want the federal government picking up my trash. I want a private entity picking up my trash, and then the government can regulate that.
And competitive.
And it's competitive bidding, yeah. and it's everything else, mm-hmm. right? So that's my measuring stick for where the government stops being my servant. Yeah. I don't think government should be my dumpster, and I don't think government should be my healthcare provider.
Well, yeah, that goes back. It's another regular theme of ours is going back to Adam Smith. You know, the role of government is critical. It's the most misunderstood person in the history of economics. Government should actively promote competition and beat down anybody who gets too powerful and starts influencing instead of competing, bullying.
Right.
That is the role. He never said greed is good. That's
right. And look at Ma Bell. I mean, if you're old enough to remember one mm-hmm. telephone company.
Yeah, I'm familiar with the story.
But I remember as a kid hearing the horror stories that we'll never get another phone call across if they break up mm-hmm. the big telephone company. And they broke it up, mm-hmm. and within 5 years, the price of a long-distance call yep. had dropped by 90%. And when through the 90s, you could not open up your mailbox that you weren't getting a $50 check to switch to a different phone company, right? It was practically a full-time mm-hmm. job switching from different phone companies. So the free market economy can work when the free market economy is not then controlled by the government, who is then kowtowing to the big corporations. Right.
But then at the same time, AT&T has gotten so big, they're actually unreliable. And you really
don't
have
a choice. Not only them. I mean, there's some. Right. But now it's, we it's get to the point. Them. It kind of we got back. We've allowed them to consolidate more, to become more powerful.
Turn back into monopolies.
Now we're exactly. I mean, right. It's not technically monopoly, right? It's not one company. It's an oligopoly. But de facto, they don't compete. They make sure they don't compete, or just on the margin a little bit. So.
Yeah, that's right.
Just straight a little bit. Right, and now we pay twice as much as the average rich world for our internet service. That's where it hurts me every time to go with my European friends, and they have like you know
on the own 100
megabytes
that we paid
for 15
money.
Euro a month
right. on the own infrastructure that we paid for with our tax money.
Yeah,
you know that's what burns me the most is that they're making money off of our money.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah, and again, the European is a that's the thing. Often when it works, you know, let's not forget that Europe has lots of problems. But when it does work, as it does to some extent better than here in the telecom, it's precisely the government is providing a role similar to what you're suggesting. I mean, these are private companies providing these services, but there's very light but critical regulation. For example, the ability to lease each other's lines. I got to give a plug to my son Felix at some point when he was first aware of the notion of having a cell phone and using it. So it's like a long time ago, frankly. And I described it to him I was trying to figure out which company to choose. You know, where will I have high-speed coverage? Yeah? It was 3G days still. He was shocked. And what, you mean every company has its own entire network that's not compatible with each other? So he asked me, why don't we have one network where everybody runs on it? Maybe the government has the network and it leases it out, or somebody else constructs it and leases it. So that's one of those things where there's an agreement, I think, between the socialists and the libertarians in many ways that we understand, you know, that this cannot work like that. I mean, that's my hope. Otherwise, we are so...
Right.
Right. A word that I can't use in the air.
I think it's the otherwise. I'm afraid it is the otherwise because I don't trust that there's even somebody or some group of people that are overseeing this. I think it is anarchy at the top.
It is. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's a kind of a warlord situation.
In my dream, it's a conspiracy where there's somebody running their strings, right?
The things they're getting away with nowadays, they would not get away with back in the 50s or in the 40s. They would actually get clubbed to death.
It's a way in which actually a lot of the documentaries, like we started talking, the somewhat silly if entertaining, shall we plug him, you know, with the caller will call us again. Sure. I love a wonderful caller from last week, you know, Alex Jones, my favorite right-wing conspiracy nut, you know. Yeah, he's a bit of a nut, but somehow I enjoy his work. This, you know, Illuminati, Bilderberg Group, you know, and all the who is controlling the world behind the scene. It's like the Hollywood also feeds onto it. Sometimes I wonder if there isn't an office somewhere in the CIA or the NSA that actually comes up with this stuff.
I'm sure there is.
Then we talk about the Illuminati instead of the public people who are right there in front of us who are doing it, you know, to us openly. Yeah, so, yeah, I think it's quite chaotic. And it's a systemic. It's kind of an incentive. It's not, oh, this group of people has taken over, right? I mean, when the incentives are, you know, if you're going to be a crook, you're going to do well. If you're going to play honest, you're going to get crushed. That system yields the results.
No, and it's definitely not a democracy, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, that's pretty
one of the things that, you know, I always go and look around. I'm going to change a little direction here.
No,
guys,
please do. We always need somebody
in the corner. I see the camera. And so the idea of being under surveillance all the time is one of the things that I pay attention to, because I'm going, okay, where are they watching us now? Mm-hmm. So when you were talking about earlier, just a little bit ago, about, you know, is there somebody that's really monitoring everything? You really...
Smithy's watering right now. Here.
We know those cameras are everywhere, and then, you know, every email, every phone call can be monitored, so mm-hmm. I don't know.
And is, we know, you know.
Yeah.
And apparently it's not even, I was actually a little bit shocked, a bit disappointed by the American people, because usually I always say the American people are much smarter than, you know, we give them credit, the media portrays them as, and the politics, you know, people kind of know what they need, like, you know, knowing that these reforms are necessary and compromise are necessary, and people aren't that stupid, but... Snowden is not a complete national hero. Edward Snowden revealed the NSA surveillance. I was like, what?
Yeah, you read the book.
I was a little disappointed that Americans aren't overwhelmingly, except for some, you know, angry,
too.
You know. Well, he's, you know.
I think he's kind of shocked and surprised himself sitting in Russia.
Yeah. So there's something, the respect for authority, but I'm 100% with you. There's a lot of that. I mean, in some sense, this is the failure of the liberal democracy. And I'm using liberal in the kind of global definition of, you know, moderate Republicans in America, right? I mean, they're not, it's so confusing. It's like, we've got to do something about this word confusion. It's because liberals call themselves liberals because they don't want to call themselves socialists like they're called everywhere in the world, right? Moderate socialists are, you know, just as business friendly as anyone. But you know, the prosperity that was promised us in the post-war era kind of failed, tepid out. Somehow in the mid-70s, things started to go sour and never really recovered.
Yeah,
all over the Western world, and Asia, you know, if we need to add some of it. So they switched. It's like Adam Curtis has a wonderful BBC series about that. They kind of switched to scaring us. They can't deliver the dream, so they will provide the nightmare, in a sense.
And at some point, the political parties realize that sales takes place in the side of the brain that's emotional, not logical. So they started selling us on the emotional plugs, right? So no party is running on a logical, good business structure. They're running on the terror that if the other party gets in, you will not be allowed these rights and these will be taken away from you, right? So it turned into a big sales machine and it stopped being about serving the nation.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, again, to be the, I agree, but I wonder to what extent. I mean, maybe there's more of it. Again, and the system is such that you can get away with murder and even get a bonus for it. While before it was a little bit more difficult. I like to think sometimes, and you know, I mean, people will hopefully know that it comes from a worry and a place of love, like Cornel West says, but it always blows my mind, the electoral system and the donation. In most parts of the world, in the most corrupt bleep holes in the world, sure, you buy politicians, the oldest game in the book, but you, and everybody knows, but you come at night with a bag full of money. You know, you don't do it on public, in public, on television. You know,
you don't have your big banner in front of them while they're talking.
Yeah, at least
$5 billion donation
back door at night. You do it. You know, so that's terrible. I've been totally addicted, and I'll do a plug. I suppose I can do a plug to art like that, right? Because we can't be commercial or anything, but we can talk about it. The Borgias. Not the historical family and all that. It's great, but there are actually two series, so you got to get the right one, the Showtime one. It's brilliant. It's really well done. So just a plug of check it out, see if you like it. I think it's on Netflix. I'm pretty sure. But I'm thinking about that because that was really almost, you know, the Borgias became a historical kind of a paradigm of power-hungry corruption.
Yeah.
But those guys are altar boys, you know, next to business as usual, you know, in Washington, Berlin, London. It's not, you know, and America's not alone in this.
Right. Well, when we had our Tammany Hall, but it
yes,
was like,
that was
you know,
pretty good.
it wasn't a national dynamic, mm-hmm. right? It was a state that had
right.
allowed itself to become so embedded in corruption that mm-hmm. it was clearly dysfunctional.
Yeah.
And now it's we have extraordinary dysfunction at the
it's fully level. Systemic. Again, this is like, okay, somebody captures the power and corrupts the institution for a while, like the Borgias. But then you typically there's some kind of reaction. Well, it's hopefully there will be. Like I said, I mean, hopefully we can avoid the dark ages and come to. Well, you know, my only political platform is that people of all persuasions that aren't duped by this Punch and Judy game come and argue together. I mean, we don't, let's say, you know, a libertarian and a socialist don't agree about exactly how monetary policy should be run. Maybe even fundamental, you know, to all the Ron Paul on campus, there are a lot of them, you know, supporters. You know, I like him for a lot of things, especially his anti-imperialism. But the gold standard, it can't work on multiple levels. There are other interesting ideas. Our friend, you know, Corey, I don't know if he wants me to say his full name at this point. He's got a big career. So let's just say Corey.
He hasn't been here for a while. Why
I know
that?
He's in Chicago.
He's scared.
Oops, too much information. but wrote a paper for me, with independent studies, fascinating stuff about pegging the money to energy. There's a lot of interesting advantages to incentivize better, more efficient energy for one of them. So it potentially, if done right, can be a big positive for the environment too, as well as provide stability. But it's not counter-cyclical. It is counter-cyclical. So it stabilizes the economy, unlike the gold standard, which is just unmatchable peg that will cause deflation and trouble, as it did in the past. So we have disagreement about what to do. Let's put them aside for a moment. Let's construct democracy, hence the things like the Constitutional Conference. I mean, hell, the Founding Fathers would be probably spinning hypersonically in their graves, a lot of them, considering what they're, you know, how they're used. But they would think it's insane that we haven't rapidly reformed the Constitution until now. I mean, we're running on 18th century.
Right, right.
Now, what? It's all the I learned that from Lawrence Lessig, not personally, you know, reading him. It's all set up to be done, and it's doable. And one of the things they're doing is for the state level, which is a little bit easier because it's a little bit less held by the powers that be. it's not a TV show, so what's being held, you can imagine. So we create a functioning democracy in which we have a functional argument between different ideologies, world concepts, political views, etc. And then whoever wins, wins. I think there's 80% for that third party. Because you're saying, you can't have a third party, you know. For that one, though, for the nonpartisan one. Top of the hour?
Yeah, top of the
okay,
hour.
Okay, let's do that, and you can you can tell me why I'm wrong in a minute.
Okay. All right. we'll be right back with Punkonomics. You're listening to WPRK Winter Park, Florida, the voice of Rollins College and the Best in Basement Radio.
The views and opinions expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WPRK, its management, or employees of Rollins College.
All right, welcome back to Punkonomics here on WPRK, Winter Park, Florida, the voice of Ronald's College and the best in basement radio. And we're talking about business corporations, internships, entrepreneurship, and several other things. And back here with Dr. Benjamin Balick.
Oh, okay. Moderator, eh? So I'm supposed to moderate. Moderator. I'm still a little bit shaky on the moderator thing.
Okay, well then if you're not comfortable with it, then we can always pass it on.
Yeah, well, see, I don't know, you know? I mean, I'm like so, you know me, I'm not exactly a formal guy.
He's afraid that when he walks out, he's going to see a bunch of dumpsters on fire and, you know.
No, I'm just not sure that they'll be comfortable with me showing up before all the many, many, you know, respectable people, you know, rubbing my beard and going like, so, yeah, yo.
People with pitchforks, burn him to stake.
No, I think that's part of the interest, you know. It's, you have to have controversy to be able to have anything that's, people aren't there to just listen, they're there to have a dialogue, so it's good if you're
no panel. I'm happy, I'm not shy, but I wonder. I mean, you know, you can ask. I mean, I'm just warning that I'm not very good at the kind of presenting people and being kind of formal MC.
Yeah, no problem.
Sometimes there's a role for being better than that. Than me,
I've got that.
All right, just yeah, good. That'd be smart. So don't be afraid, come to the event at 7 today if you're interested. Federal Reserve documentary, quite good. We discussed a little bit. We went on many tangents as usual, and that's why we do this, because it's fun. It's not like we're getting paid or anything. Yeah,
that's right. another internship.
It's part of it's just part of my plan to take over the world.
Just kidding.
Yeah, well, you know, Jesse can get testy a little bit in this current job market.
Know.
I feel you. And maybe it's time also to repeat one of the things that aren't repeated enough. The economy is in an abysmal shape, and there's no recovery for the majority of people, and there's no jobs, and it's awful. And no, I'm not joining the camp, because that's part of the Punch and Judy kind of political situation. So I'm like, so you're saying that Obama didn't make the economy? It's his fault? No. He inherited the crisis. He's just not really doing what
needs to be done.
He promised to do and Americans want him to do, and maybe it's not. And, so you hate Obama? No, frankly, I don't think he has the power to do it, because he's not really calling the shots. Sure, would I have hoped that he would have shown himself to be some kind of FDR? Hell, if FDR came out of his grave today, the system in which he would become president would be such that he cannot. FDR had a major organized union. Jesse earlier talked about the state in which most of our big unions are. And actually, it's great that I remember, because I wanted to say there's a lot of discussion among left-leaning, you know, people and union people, etc., of really undermining. There's a much complaint. You know, the right's always like, unions are bad. Maybe, but we would be in a slave economy without them today. They made America great back in the 19th century and early 20th century. And FDR had a 30% active union membership when he was in power, so he could make the necessary changes in the face of the banksters, the same banksters who were trying to get him to do what they're getting our government today to do. But I want people to know that there's a lively left-wing discussion about precisely what to do about it, how to undermine these apparatchik running these unions badly, more grassroots movements, get rid of the big guys, that kind of corruption and following one's own thing. And having said that, I am quickly trying to navigate the awful Facebook. Everybody knows Facebook has an awful mobile app, because there was another event that I was invited to, but can't because I'm doing the documentary today. And that is the first meeting to try, and I'd like to plug it, absolutely, to start 15 Now, which is the movement around the nation to get a higher, and they're ambitious, $15 minimum wage. And that's doubling the minimum wage. So I wanted to, you know, to some of my friends are hosting it. I wish I could be there. I'll try and come to the next meeting. It's in a CWA 3108 Union Hall. It's in 2220 Edgewater Drive in Orlando, Florida, today at 7. So if you're interested in that, by all means, go. And I'm sure we'll have them on the show eventually, too.
It should be noted that if the minimum wage from when America's capitalism was at its peak in terms of its productivity, its growth, its innovation, everything in the mid-70s, if we had kept the cost of living adjustment on the minimum wage back then throughout these years, like our government members of Congress get their pay raised along the cost of living, then it would indeed be today, depending how you measure it, 12, 13, 15.
Right, you know, if they just follow the progression that Disneyland has here, as far as raising the tickets to go and see Mickey Mouse, you know, to the cost of living, we probably would be at $15 minimum wage.
Yeah, but that would, you know, something like that. It would be. It's not outlandish at all. And yeah, but those were the days where, you know, workers, you know, lower middle class, working class families could retire. Even one worker in the family, potentially, you know. I'm certainly not against women working if they want to, but it's what we have, and here's some horrible tragedy from the news, right? Last week, we have a young girl working four jobs, like most of the poor people, with a can of gasoline in the car, who died, you know. To death. I mean, the degree of misery is another thing that is, like, shocking, but we don't really see it.
But you know, we can't really blame the politicians fully about that. A lot of it has to do with us, plain and simple, because those days that you're talking about are the days of Leave It to Beaver or June Cleaver, okay, which is really early 50s, you know, and that's the mentality they had back then.
I'd like to say.
Okay, but I know somewhere you saw the program.
It's
you know,
on TV
YouTube.
Land.
It's on YouTube. It's on YouTube. I'll send you a couple of links. But that was the mentality back then. Mm. And, of course, they followed the mentality all the way through the 60s. And then I don't know what happened in the 70s where they went like, oh, okay, we don't need to have one person stay at home or, you know, okay, fine. And then...
Well, it's above all, wages started going down.
Everybody's wages started going down, exactly. Exactly. The moment they allowed women to go into the job place, which was a great thing, you know, by all means, they were like, okay, well, now both of them are working. They don't need all that money.
Well, in many cases, women may be the other way around. Maybe women went to work because they had to. Because women already work, typically.
Well, because a single mom, you're right. Yeah, single moms having to go back out there and work. One of the things that I was struck when I... went overseas. This was years ago, but in Switzerland, even everybody was supposed to have a job. So their unemployment was really, really low. So everybody was paid for something. And even if you were a stay-at-home mom, there was still a salary for a stay-at-home mom. I guess that's the ultimate.
That's real feminism.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
But
and that's a good thing.
Yeah, because the job was to take care of the family there. No problem with that. You know, I think that's a really good thing also. But, you know, when you have so many people that have children out of wedlock, you have single parents, then you're going to have to see that there's going to be more women in the workforce, more, you know, men that are supporting their children too. So it's not just a one-sided.
Sure, no, but it's also just that the wage is going down. You really need the two salaries, and then you need credit too, and you know where that got us.
So in other words, the salary of one person now is basically shared among two people. Mm-hmm. They didn't go any further ahead of the ball game as far as economically or financially.
And it's not like you get free childcare or a decent education system. Or so your options are basically women are now asked to say, not only are you going to do your full-time job as a mom, I mean, sure, I mean... Right there, you know, I help around, but still overwhelmingly, statistically speaking, women do most of the work around the children.
Yeah, I
the
would
house.
Agree with that. So right. Being Absolutely. The woman in the house, yes.
Yeah, right. You know.
But I mean, that's the sad part is that they should have, it was such a good thing to allow everybody to have the choice of, you know, go to work or stay at home, that they went like, well, okay, how can we add some evil behind it? Well, of course, let's reduce their wages. You know, let's not let these middle
that's
class
the unions.
People. Right.
The lack of, they're all the busting of the unions. Mm-hmm. That's but one of the things. I mean, even the crappy, often unions that we have.
Like the Teamsters Airline Division?
There's a very close correlation between unionization and wages. Like, unionization goes down, wages go down, duh. And you hear people talking, I mean, that's, you know, like, oh, we don't need unions. I mean, I'm like...
And well, the worst part about it is
I guess you don't need wages.
Then, what's going to end up being said about the whole affordable health care, then? Does that mean that affordable health care is going to be adjusting, or are we just increasing wages to try and accommodate that need?
Well, what, the Affordable Health Care Act?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was a cop-out, you know. That was, again, maybe well-intentioned. But what needed to be done was off the table right away. So it was basically
Medicare for everyone.
We had to have universal health care in one way or another. Hybrid, obviously, majority provided by private competitive industry. But the incentives not to make big industry wanting to get the people as sick as possible for profit.
You know, and I actually see that going the same direction as most businesses with deregulation, honestly. I don't see the healthcare system getting any better. I think it's going to wind up turning into a big mess, not because the concept is bad, but because there's some people upstairs who just cannot get enough money, plain and simple.
Hmm? Yeah, no, I mean, it becomes, and again, I mean, getting filthy rich, that's often comes up in my classes too, you know? I mean, so what's wrong with getting filthy rich? Nothing, unless you're doing it at the expense of somebody else.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the problem.
We're in a crazy flux right now. We're going to go visit a client tomorrow who, it's a clinic, and they've been providing free health care, and it's now illegal for them to provide free health care. And so,
how were they providing, by donations?
No, they were being supported because there was a Florida program where if you were had no income, you could apply to get your health care, and you'd get a Florida waiver, and you could go to one of these designated clinics, and then there'd be surgeons or doctors that would take care of your dental or diagnostic needs in these free clinics.
Now that's a Florida amendment, though, right? That's something that Florida state legislature changed. Because as far as I know, I'm from California, and the Hate Free Clinic is still operating.
Under the Affordable Care Act, there should be no free clinic because everyone should have health insurance now. So they can't support free health clinic programs and not undermine their stand that everyone has health insurance. So if everyone has health insurance, why do you need free clinics? So the reason we're going to visit this clinic is they need to, you know, be looked at and what would it take for this clinic to get Medicare certified so that they can now accept Medicare certification
in the visit.
Okay. So it's no longer a free to people who can't afford it. This was part of the infrastructure that was designed to pick up the people that could not, that had no place to turn, right? And so Florida, like California, I don't know if you'd call it progressive, but they set up an infrastructure to take care of the people who could not find health care elsewhere. So that's part of the transition, right? And there's now there's like all these people who are lost in the willows because the Affordable Care Act isn't free health care. It still costs money. And if, you know, we're just talked about the working homeless, you got people working two jobs, living out of their car. Mm-hmm. Where's the money they're going to come up with to pay for their affordable health care when they don't even have enough food to feed their kids? And the only food they're getting is the free lunch program at school. So it is, it's a tough thing. And, you know, it's we talked earlier in the show about gaming, right? And we need a gaming culture to solve these solutions, because there is no looking in the rearview mirror at what used to work to figure out what's going to work tomorrow. And I think that's part of the problem with anyone who says something. Everyone's going to say why it doesn't work because look at history. Well, history's not in front of us, it's behind us. So if you have a gaming mentality, which is you're not afraid to make a mistake because you got to try something new, you're a rat in a maze and you've never made it through this maze before. So that's the kind of mentality and courage that we need to forge through. And that's one of the things I liked about this movie when we talked about how it's non-political. It's fact-based. And if we're in the dark ages, we need a renaissance.
It's very moderate, quite frankly. I would have made it angrier.
But you know, there's nothing wrong with cheating either. Absolutely. I mean, because you look at Taiwan and some of these other countries, they're doing it. They're providing health care for their people, and it's very sustainable. So, I mean, there's no reason why we shouldn't.
There's problems.
These countries.
It's not, I mean, all countries. America is completely unique in this sense. But
the problem that we do have here is that anytime you mention any kind of health care that's outside of the mentality of the United States, right away it's associated with communism and socialism.
No, but Obama won the election for two reasons. Number two, the war, that he was one of the few people who. Well, now we find that he's, you know, more warlike than, you know, only Hillary Clinton will be even more nutter than him. Bomb him! Bomb him! Bomb him!
Let's leave that one for
another show. But the most, possibly the biggest thing was healthcare. I mean, Americans want healthcare. I mean, for decades, you ask Americans, what do they want? They want a good education system and a good healthcare system. Instead, it's this racket. The sicker the people are, the more profit is derived. If we had people sitting around and trying to solve our problems, then right. I'm with you 100%, right? I mean, yeah. But they're not in office.
Right.
But even the system around you is set up to keep people sick. I mean, go to Walmart. Every single fatty type food is at Walmart. Who shops at Walmart? Well, most people who don't have any money or are unemployed, right?
I will say under the Affordable Care Act, for the first time in my life, I was required to get a physical for my health insurance. And my health insurance was rated based on my physical fitness. And that I think that's a good thing. I think that
but it also could be bad.
Yeah, it can make a good incentive.
It had me look at how am I going to eat, because I knew in 6 months I'm going to get a physical that's going to judge what my rate on health insurance is. And if I'm not in good, if my blood pressure's high, and if I'm overweight, if I'm suffering from things that come from things that I have some poor ability choices. To control.
Sure. But then what happens when you are sick? And you're getting sicker. I mean, your rates are going
to
go up.
Well, it has to be done right. But
you know, they're not saying if you have, you know, they're not checking to see whether I have cancer or something like that. They're literally looking at my lifestyle, and gauged on my lifestyle is how I pay my rates, which is no different than car insurance. If I get in a lot of accidents, my car insurance is going up.
Right, sure.
No, there's actually, we use a similar nudge theory. I can't think, and the internet is really in a bad shape here in the studio right now, so I'll just not try. I can't give the proper reference. I'm sorry. Anybody interested? Just, you know, fire me an email, go to Punkonomics, I don't know, make a comment, ask a question. But using it for a paper recently with a student about precisely doing the kind of the behavioral science behind gamifying courses and using the nudge. So this is a classic example of a nudge, right? So, you know, tomorrow I don't teach. So ideally, my wife takes the kids to school, and I stay at home, and I walk the dog, and maybe run, and do some swimming, and all that. But sometimes I do, and sometimes I'm not. Often I'm caught up by work. It's not like I kick back and open up a beer and watch a movie, you know? Though that's happened too. But that nudge would be, in 6 months. If I'm like a little bit less weight, a little bit more, a little nudge there, you know, come on, put that, you know, and then that extra $100 you're going to not have to pay for the insurance, you can spend on
drinking,
you know, and get fat again. But so that's a kind of a nudge. It's not like it determines your behavior, but given that you're already trying to stay a little healthy.
Sure. And I'm all for the incentives. The problem is that there are other people that look at it from a different point of view. And it's kind of like, well, okay, if this person is sick and they're getting sicker, then what are the possibilities they're going to get well? Not really? Okay, fine, let's bring the rates up. I mean, deny them. Yep. What's to stop them from doing that?
That's actually supposedly one of the things that the Obamacare has a little bit plugged. I mean, listen. We had to deliver something. You know, it's not as easy to. It's much more difficult for companies to deny coverage for people who are insured. Than it used to be before, quite easy. So we'll give them that, no problem. And perhaps, I mean, I know it was supposed to, in theory, back when it was still being argued, also plug some of the really uninsured, and it probably still does. But what you were talking about, especially when lots of states aren't extending Medicare and all that, so that's been really torpedoed in a very shameful way by the Republicans. I'll give you that, Jesse. You know, it's like the psycho party and the wussy party, right?
Right, exactly. But I mean, you know, and you can take this even further. I mean, several years ago, several corporations were actually using tests to determine whether their new employee that was being hired was pregnant. Mm-hmm. So, you know, again, what's to stop them from using that kind of information against their actual patient? So there's a lot of concern with that. You know, I get the letters all the time, have your physical and all that. They want to send their doctor, not my doctor, their doctor. Mm-hmm. And I refuse that every single time. It's like, well, I don't want everybody else to know my condition. Why should I share that information with
there's
them?
Privacy there's privacy issues with medical, issues. Absolutely.
And they're actually doing that. They're also regulating the price of your medication, regardless whether you've been on it for 5 or 10 years.
Right. Which and is God forbid, where are they keeping your medical records on the cloud?
And well, that's just it. And then they require each time, and do this every year, they require each time for you to go back to your doctor, pay all this money for them to write a report of why you need this medication.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I don't know. I'm just not really too thrilled about the healthcare system. I'm glad that it's staging an approach to cover everybody, but then at the same time, this is my train of thought. Everybody is good, you know, except that you just can't trust the evil in people. I mean, that little
green monster. Wait up. Here's my dear wife, Charlotte, just texted me something about that. It's like, so she was saying, what about, like you were saying, if you're poor, you eat badly, right? Because good food is, anybody who's a bit of a food Nazi like my family is, you know, knows how much it costs, right, to eat decent food. And then you're sicker, and she's right. I mean, we know that in America, the poor people are the ones who are overweight, right? They don't have the leisure to go to the gym, or
except for Oprah,
et cetera, et cetera. Right.
They can still go for walks. Come on, but now they don't have to go to a gym. They can still
between
go
the
for a
four jobs and stuff. You know, right. You have to have the mentality of, you know, they're too stressed out. I mean, there's a major issue of stress with poverty.
I've seen people go through the grocery store with their food stamps and they're swiping their card, and they still pick out everything that's in there. Their cart.
That's because that's the only thing that's cheap.
But that's what they can. That's just so much more expensive.
Even Walmart is expensive.
But do you know that even at the many of the local farmers markets, they take those cards now?
They do.
Yeah.
It's still by cash. So if you're going to buy green beans like I buy them for $5 per person,
they'll take their cards. They can swipe their cards right there on the spot.
Yeah, but they still have to pay the more expensive product. So it won't go as far as it will to buy.
Exactly. But if you're going for the locally grown stuff, then that's usually cheaper than what's in the grocery store. Mm. If you've gone to the farmer's market, if you've shopped the specials.
Honestly, I don't even have, I don't have time to go to the farmer's market. It's a bit of a little bit of a leisure class thing.
Yeah,
you know?
No, it's over here at Winter Park.
Yeah,
yes,
Saturdays,
but the one
right?
There's the whole issue of, you know, it's difficult to be optimizing and super rational unless you have the mental, you know, even if you're busy, you know, you have the mental calm, the security. It's actually, there's a tremendous amount of stress-induced problems among the poor.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Among black population, as very much in the news, is notoriously, since, you know, the cops are running behind trying to gun you down and kill your children. You tend to be a little stressed out. Yeah. I like to say it like that sometimes, because it so ticks me off. But the thing is then, what I was saying, that under this scheme, though, then poor people will have to pay higher insurance
rates.
That's right.
I think that's an accurate point. And the stress level, look at type 2 diabetes and how it's grown in the United States.
Absolutely.
And it's grown, I don't know, but I'd be interested to see a study of what socioeconomic classes it's grown more in. Because to that point, can you imagine... Mm. I'm a father of four. I can't imagine being a father of four living out of a car.
Yeah, right.
Right?
Yeah, right.
I mean, there's like every day is, you know, this fight flight dynamic of stress and care, mm-hmm. and working two jobs living out of a car. It's unimaginable.
And they get sick, and then you have to heal. I mean, even at upper middle class, you know, my daughter's prone to accident. Touch wood, right?
Yeah,
hasn't been a while. You know, so you go to emergency, they want 8 hours wait for triage, you know, and then they tell us that in Winter Park, you know, and then they tell us we go do three hospitals, end up basically self-diagnosing on WedMD, what to do about a concussion, you know. In most civilized countries, you know, whether you pay for it in taxes or what, you pay much less. In America, healthcare is monstrously expensive, but you call the people come to your house. You know, in an emergency with a child. So that just the degree of security that it's involved. And then they tell us in the rhetoric circus about healthcare that, you don't want socialized healthcare because the wait times are so long. You know,
right.
That was true in the 70s, and then they reformed them. Actually, capitalistically, ironically enough. The reason why America now has the longest wait times in the world, in the rich world, certainly. You know, France, England, Canada had long wait times, but then they harnessed the forces of private providers. But that's a big topic. Theoretically speaking, I think, the way I understand the literature, you can't even have private health insurance working as the core. You can have the hybrid system. It's a matter of information asymmetry. They will always go bankrupt as a private corporation or become a predatory institution.
Yeah.
Maybe like in most countries today, you just have a core guarantee, very minimal, and then you buy further insurance to compensate for it, depending on how much you're willing to spend and how much copay you want and things like that. But you have to have some kind of anchor, and that was indeed suggested in the early discussions, right, to have the public options, to add competition.
That's
but
right.
No, the Obama administration was told by its backers, no, we want a captive audience. We don't want competition. Yeah. Competition is the enemy of big business.
You know, to give you an idea, you were asking about the diabetes situation. My mom has got diabetes, so, you know, after a while you get to be very knowledgeable about it. And from what I've seen, and the population of the U.S., it's about 80% of the people that have diabetes belong to African-American community.
That's a literal, yeah.
Hispanic community.
Yep.
Epidemic.
Poor.
Yeah.
Everything
above from that is you know,
yeah,
is guessing. But yeah, 80%.
You get better. I mean, when you get older, of course, you know that usually when it's supposed to hit. But now it's the scary bit is kids. Precisely, so many kids are diabetic.
Yep.
And they, given the way diabetes works, it's the damage takes time. So my God, they will be blind when they're 40.
That's right.
It's awful.
Yep.
It's a crime, really. I mean, you know, that's where I might have the affinity with those crazy right-wing conspiracy theorists that are yelling with their face red, you know? It's like, you should get angry. It's a crime.
You know, and
poison
and
your children. I mean, it's like some out of some kind of horrible fairy tale.
Right. You know, and a couple of weeks ago when we had Clayton Farrar from Ideas, it's one of our guests had been in Africa dealing with Ebola virus and all that. You know, it goes right back to what have we done, you know, with research, because the last thing that was cured was polio. Mm-hmm. You know, now they're saying that they actually have something that might work for Ebola, and I'm going like, well, okay. You know, that comes out periodically every 5 or 10 or 8 years, but what about diabetes? You know, what are we doing for diabetes? I mean, and some of these other diseases. So it just goes back to what we were saying, that these huge corporations that own the pharmaceuticals have no intention of curing any of these diseases.
Well, maybe they already have the cures, but they don't want to release it.
Right, some
conspiracy
say
theory.
Sure.
There's a couple things. One, inside of healthcare, there's a dynamic in the American healthcare system where the United States was the forefront of research and development. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of the new MRIs and CTs that would come out, the research for the studies that could be done on those was all funded through the American healthcare infrastructure. So we did pay a really high price. And the rest of the world did benefit. You know, it's much easier to come in behind. Mm. And you know, I used to sell imaging equipment, and I would sell a lot of the old single and two and four slice CTs that had run their course through the United States, and then they'd be shipped over to Europe. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we talk about healthcare. All healthcare is not created equal. The healthcare that's provided in other countries where it's free, they're using technologies that are 2, 3, 12 years old. Right, that are way past their prime, and it's sort of the difference between having an iPhone when it first came out and having a flip phone. You both could make a phone
true,
call,
true,
right?
True.
And then,
not in the rich European countries, on the contrary.
No, of course, there's some.
We're now behind. It's almost like the other way around now. It used to be surely.
And it's also regulatory, because you know, when one of the ways that the big corporations control their lock is to use that what they know the FDA will and will not approve in new technologies. So they'll have 128 slice CTs that are available in other countries. We're not even allowed to use them in this country yet. Right? So it's that flip.
And why? It's not like we're particularly heavy-handed regulators. Who's benefiting from this?
Who's
getting paid?
We are. And when it comes to the FDA, and I know for a fact that there are products that will sanitize a surface and stop viral or contaminants from sitting and growing on that surface, and it has a hold time where it can keep that surface sanitized for 24 hours. But the FDA is not going to regulate that, because you've got you've got companies that will it would and their soap
banish,
industry.
Right,
exactly.
Banish,
that's
right.
What I was thinking.
Right?
There,
so,
that I get.
So
that
you when you look at that, imaging is a multi-billion dollar industry, mm-hmm. and you know that, you know, your hold on your hospital niche is that they need a 3 to 8 year life expectancy of that piece of equipment to afford a $3 million investment into it. They want that investment to pay off. And so it's a double-edged sword when it comes to, you know, restricting the revenues that are available off of healthcare. Mm-hmm. But there was, as someone who helped develop surgery centers for years, there was a lot of money being made in that, mm-hmm. right? It's not like it was goodwill. It was a profitable business to take outpatient surgery out of the hospital, put it in a freestanding facility, and do outpatient surgery. That was big money. And my job was to actually go and meet with those physician groups and show them the money that they were losing by doing those procedures in the hospital. And so, you know, when I look at healthcare from an inside and outside standpoint, the number one thing that shows up for me is that what gets lost in the entire conversation is the patient. Right? We look at the healthcare and the Affordable Care Act from, well, how does this affect litigation? And how does this affect the hospitals? And how does this affect the doctors? And we tend to forget that the only reason we have a healthcare industry is because there are patients out there.
Bingo.
And so
one of our clients
is the Florida Patient
Association.
Mm. And it really is, it's a nonprofit that's being started to focus on the care for the patient. Like, what is the advocacy for the patient when it comes to their legal rights, especially if we're going to go to state-run institutions where you have no right to litigation? They could drop you on the floor, and so what? That's the state. You can't sue the state. So if we're going to go to a single-payer or a state-run healthcare infrastructure, let's not forget that the whole purpose of this institution is to take care of patients.
Oh yeah, and it's not easy. I mean, you have to create the incentives and the functional regulatory structure and all of these things. But I wanted to, one thing that kind of popped into my mind is a lot of the end moment, the developing the tools themselves, whether it be an iPhone or whether it be a sophisticated imaging technology like you were describing. It tremendously depends on long run again some primarily public investment. It's often kind of a especially in technology. I'll never forget a student who now I know, you know, ex-student that I like him very much. But the first time I ever saw him, he came up with this ludicrous statement in the middle of a discussion about healthcare, in which why can't it be all private, you know, just like our technology? And I'm like, excuse me? I mean, that's American socialism at its best. I mean, where all this technology was developed in with National Science Foundation money. You know, to taxpayers in public universities.
Department of
by
Defense.
By some estimates, above 90% of all the technology was actually publicly funded. Now, if you then package it beautifully, imply it well, wear a black turtleneck and sell it, then go for it. Get rich, the late Steve Jobs. No problem there. But iPhone is 90%... homegrown American socialism, be a little facetious.
But, you know, I actually contributed all that to William Shatner in Star Trek.
Yeah.
That's where it all came from.
I mean,
MRIs, your phone. Okay. Yeah. I mean, it was basically inspired by that little program, even though he's Canadian. But, you know, there you go.
No, well, the writer was Gene Roddenberry.
True.
Shatner was just, you know, kissing aliens.
Well, he was the captain.
Well.
And fighting with Takei. Oh, dear, dear, dear. Wow, we've breached a whole bunch of stuff.
Yes, we have.
One question. We didn't get a caller, huh? I guess we're...
They're still out there. 407-646-2915. You want to jump into the discussion or have some comments, we welcome them at this moment. You're listening to Punkonomics here on WPRK, Winter Park, Florida, Voice of Rollins College, and the Best in Basement Radio. We'll be right back with our informal talk show.
The views and opinions expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WPRK, its management, or employees of Rollins College.
Breaking rocks in the hot sun. I thought the law in the law won. Yeah, I thought the law in the law won. I needed money cause I had none. I thought the
all right, welcome back to Punkonomics here on WPRK, Winter Park, Florida. The voice of Rollins College and the best in basement radio. And we're getting close here to the end of our program. We got about 15 more minutes and we were definitely discussing a whole bunch of topics here. So, back in the discussion,
Yeah, we went to a cheery topic just now. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Follow up on Ebola.
That's a real cheery topic.
Yeah. Well, our listeners know that, you know, I'm a very sensitive boy, and my defense against the horrors of this world is a very dark sense of humor. Okay? I always have to tell it to my students because there were the past sometimes when people, he said what? You know, they didn't realize that I was being just, you know, kind of ironic. So a disclaimer, there we are. So yeah, we're just saying about how you were telling us. Tell us. I mean, again, of how.
Well, when I first heard about Ebola coming out, there was you could tell as soon as it had spread from 2 villages to 6 villages that this was not going to stop anytime soon, right? And then this got brought up because my son sent me a clip to a video last night where. There's a guy who had escaped from an Ebola clinic and was being chased down the street by guys in hazmat suits. This could not have been choreographed better by a Hollywood movie producer
or video
for a video game for the Tuesday night movie of the week. And I talked to my son about it. I'm like, this is the zombie apocalypse, right? Mm-hmm. Ebola is as horrible. Hemorrhagic fever is as horrible as a zombie apocalypse, visually, right? It's
well, they don't come eat your brain, though, so I guess.
Right. Well, Ebola does.
To look on the bright side. God. They just die horribly in awful agony. And it's terrible. You get liquefied. It's nasty. But in some sense, the fact that unlike, say, AIDS, right? I mean, it doesn't kill you that fast. Oh, sorry, it kills you so fast, Ebola, that it has a hard time spreading. In some sense, does it talk about, there's a little video game on the Android, maybe on iPhone too, Plague.
I play it all the time.
All right. Which one?
It's one of the few things I play waiting.
You are the virus, you are the bacteria, you are the amoeba, and you try to infect the entire planet.
You have to kill the entire population
of the
planet.
Every epidemiologist or you know, person studying viral contagion should play that game, right? So... The thing about Ebola and where it is the burial practices. And when we talk about could this have the same effect in the United States, we have a very different ritual practice for how we treat our dead. And this is occurring in countries where their ritual practice is to wash the bodies and then kiss them goodbye. And you could not ask for a worse behavior.
It's beautiful poetically, perhaps, but that's really bad for a contagious disease.
Yeah, and so that's part of the problem here is you've got a social behavior which is conducive to the spread of this disease. You've got an impoverished environment where there's not the infrastructure for supporting it. And the reason this person escaped from the clinic was he was starving to death. There wasn't food to feed the people in the clinic.
Yeah, it's getting to, I mean, by numbers, sometimes you might, you know, where we're talking about, like, what you were saying recently? I haven't kept it up. You were telling us, no? That
100,000.
No, no, where it's how many died so far.
Well, the official counts are something like 1,500 have died and 3,000, right? That's the official count.
Okay.
And the one thing that the CDC and the World Health Organization have both admitted is those are probably grossly underestimated, right? Because those are it's sort of like in a disaster, when a disaster happens, it's like 3 confirmed dead, and you know there's going to be 20, right? But they can't confirm them dead until they know their name, address, phone number, social security number, and they have all body parts.
And make sure they're dead too.
And make sure they're dead, right?
But then the economies and the trade and the supplies, I mean, that breaks down. Very fragile to start with.
And it's a catch-22 because the World Health Organization, if I were king of the world, I'd have shut down trade to support the control, the stop of the spread. However, there's already people starving to death in the clinic. So if you cut down trade, that reduces the food supply.
I mean, you could ship it in, but then again, you have to move it around and things like that. So when it hits a country that's already very poor. And unstable. I mean, a lot of horrible civil wars, etc. Then it's twice as bad. I mean, even in America, we saw something. I mean, Katrina.
Yeah.
Right. It was a terrible storm, sure, but you know, the levees were not where they were supposed to be. It was, you know, again, fraud. Very fragile population. Nobody cares about
how many
abandoned
how many...
by the police and the.
So yeah, right.
The many even hurricanes here that came before that never did anything, right? And that complacency that sets in.
The water, all the watershed areas that was dug up, so no protection. So again, I mean, we can see a pocket of fragile population and poverty in America can also be hit really hard and horribly. So we shouldn't be complacent either. Usually, and it's just like here in America too. Again, right? Whenever they have hurricanes, been a while, right? Touch wood. Or tornadoes, which is even scarier, I think, personally. Yep. It's always people in trailer parks that die, right? Mm. Because these are fragile houses, right, you know? Yeah. And when the tornado hits you, you're dead.
Yeah. I wonder when we look at the Ebola situation, if the plague, if the Black Plague had happened, you know, 50 years ago instead of, you know, what, 1,000 years ago?
Kept happening, too.
I think we'd be responding very differently as a global response because, I mean, they can't even get the proper medical resources to the areas that this is.
Right.
And if we had just recently suffered an 80 or a deduction of 70 to 80% of the world's population due to a national global pandemic, if there would still be this lackadaisical interest.
But you know, that has to do a lot with our own arrogance.
Yeah. Yeah. And,
basically.
And after in Orlando, after that summer, we got hit by like three or four hurricanes in a row. Right. After that, the next few hurricanes that glanced by, everybody was shut down. Right. I mean, you know, they called off school. They never came in. But there was like this whole different relationship to what a hurricane could do when everyone lost their roof one summer.
Right. Given the population turnaround here, I believe on the average it's like 4 years or something. I mean, that's the average length. Anybody around here in Orlando, how long have you been in Central Florida? 4 years.
4 years.
Your average answer.
Right.
So they don't remember. I mean, I'm a bit lax myself, I'll admit.
Yeah,
but again, you know,
I mean, my fear,
I mean, you know, I have a good house, right? So horrible damage, air conditioning, no electricity for 2 weeks. Like then, you know, well, I'll take the car and head north, you know? Right. Go squat at my colleague Harry's house, as I did then. So again, the risk is much more. It's not going to be so horrible if you are in relatively, you know, good situation.
Yeah.
If not, then you're fragile again.
Right. And where we ball is
sleeping in your car.
We're arrogant about, oh, that would never happen here. We have the best medical in the world and, you know, all that stuff. Yeah, we're definitely subject to getting hit by something like that.
Yeah. And if you look at the population of the world, it's ripe, right? We've got densities that we've never had, just
right.
Like we had densities that we never had during the plague.
And we got too many people on the planet.
Well, that's actually, honestly, that's actually a
that's
big
the
topic.
Truth. That is
no,
the truth.
No, well, it's a highly debatable issue.
We're a virus that's eating up this planet. Plain and simple.
Well, yeah, like the best part in The Matrix, or the best part
exactly.
of the movie The Matrix.
Exactly.
Mr. Smith talks about
it. Exactly. Oh, yeah. We are a virus. I mean, we destroy our trees. We pretty much move anything that doesn't really get along with us. You know, we either move them or we annihilate them. I mean, we've done it.
It's always been
cultures.
The case in history. It's one of the, actually, again, thing in class in economic history. Teach that. I mean, all the societies, every time, they rise, they thrive, and then they hit the environmental wall, and they collapse. Problem now is that our wall is global.
Right.
And of course, because of that, it's probably the reasons why you get all these stories about apocalypses, you know, coming and all this kind of stuff, because that's basically what's happening.
But there's nowhere
there's
to walk, you know? There's nowhere to, okay, there's no more water anymore, the fields are fallow, there's nothing, hunger and instability and war, so we, like, pack our bags and head...
Migrate
to the next valley somewhere, right?
Which brings us to going to Mars.
Yeah. But we shut down the space program.
Right.
Didn't we?
Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
Well,
exactly.
We can go with the Russians.
We can't afford it. We
no,
have
the Russians
bankers
don't want
who
us
need
anymore.
Cocaine
no,
and
yeah.
whores. So, you know, we can't go to space.
The
so.
Russians actually told us that, you know, if we want to go up to a space lab to get a trampoline, they actually said that.
Nice.
Yeah. Said that. I thought that was the best thing that I heard all the whole year. But, you know, I mean, it's to teach us a lesson because we should have never outsourced, you know, these jobs from NASA, you know, to take a taxi from Russia. That's ridiculous.
I agree.
We should have kept the jobs here, just like everything else.
Yep.
You know, jobs should be staying here. They should not be outsourced.
Yep.
You know, when you call to get tech support from Home Depot, you shouldn't be talking to somebody who barely understands your own culture or can barely speak the language.
You know what, American market socialists like Richard Wolff, who my students are reading, a senior seminar, shout out, argues that you have to have worker-owned companies.
Right.
And managed. You have to be careful. Not just owned. Owned is often kind of just a share, you know.
A profit-sharing
scheme. Profit-sharing scheme that the decision-making, yeah. Right? Work 5 days a week, and on Friday, sit at the board, everybody. Mm-hmm. Or in some kind of so democratically run companies. In a sense, you know, they will never outsource. They will not raid the pension funds. They will not, you know, they'll all for good education in the community because their kids go there. Mm-hmm. So it would be a very difficult. That's a very old school Marxist, by the way. I mean, sometimes in the show we try and kind of the nightmare that was Soviet style communism was had as much little to do with Marxism as the nightmare we're beginning to live here has got to do with free markets, you know?
Yeah. And it goes back to you said our founding fathers would be spinning in their grave. Mm. They all had real jobs.
Mm.
They and our politicians today don't.
Yeah.
And I think the third party would be like the average Joe party, where the people in the political realm actually are real people in the real world, and they maintain their real jobs because how else are you going to be in touch with your constituency if you're sitting in an office all day taking extraordinary. Compensation.
They can't even find one, right? We discovered that whenever they have the typical person, like famously the Joe the plumber.
Yeah, right. They can't even find
and many others too. They can't find it. They're
it wasn't
actors
even a plumber.
And party activists. I mean, again, it reminds me, and I keep saying it, I'll say it every time. I wish my granddad was alive. He lived in Czechoslovakia. He used to always tell, you know, when the few times we met, you know, he was tell all these horror stories about the insanity of the communist system, of just how idiotic and miserable it was. I wish we could, like, sit around a bottle of vodka and I tell you, you wouldn't believe where I've seen that again, you know, 21st century America, you know. So, but you know, again, that's a very important point. So we kind of want to underline it, this notion, not only are our politicians, professional politicians, but our management all over the place. That's maybe even related to the stuff that you encounter that it used to be that that it's a software engineer that becomes the head of the computer company. Maybe now he doesn't engineer software anymore. He does business, but he comes from there, or the textile company used to be whatever working in the company, and now mostly even in the education system, by the way, you know, and so the better schools try and should fight hard to find, you know, faculty that have a talent for administration and become administrators, and not professional administrators that went directly that route.
That's right.
And so I think it's a major disease, and a little bit also like the things we used to joke about the communists, where, you know, you'd have this kind of party member that would be parachuted from Moscow to run this steel company here in Siberia and didn't know anything about steel production, about Siberia. Nobody knew him, nobody trusted him, and it didn't work.
Right.
And the same thing happens today. The board signs, you know, let me get conspiracy theory. You know those 30,000 to 50,000 people who run the world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they're not of a certain ethnicity. They're not of a certain religious persuasion.
Well, good example of that. You know, and of course, I always refer to the airline scheme. Republic Airlines. You know, they had basically employee ownership. You know, shares in the whole bit. And the moment they switched CEOs, I think they came in with Stephen Wolf, who didn't know anything about the airlines but had a great business plan. They went like, oh, okay, fine. And then you started seeing other models where, like you were saying, people who don't have the knowledge of steel or whatever it is that they're offering are basically managing the company to increase the shares but also managing the company down to the ground because they're actually outsourcing everything.
Their incentives are often
incentives
short
are
run
off.
That's built like that.
Yeah, I remember when I started flying, the CEO was a pilot. You know, I mean, had started when the airline had just taken 50 passengers, you know, that kind of stuff, all the way to the very end to create an international airline. So then all of a sudden, because of the board of directors who are also non-airline, they said, oh, okay, we got to get this pilot out of here. He wants to buy too much equipment to keep the skies safe. You know, that costs too much money. So they bring a bureaucrat. And that's happened in many other businesses. The oil companies, my dad worked for a Gulf refinery company in Puerto Rico, and the person that they had down there was an oil man, you know, who knew how to set up rigs and the whole bit. And the moment they started breaking up the unions back in the 70s, then they started seeing all these guys that, you know, MBA but didn't know their heads from, you know, an oil well,
yep,
that kind of thing. And that's basically today. I mean, most of these CEOs and middle management came from another type of educational background that does not fit the company.
In a sense, it's a little like apprenticeship, to go back to what you guys are doing. Like, very it's true. Even at the top, you know, to learn.
And it goes back to the gaming philosophy, because if anyone thinks that how to build a company today is how you built a company in the 90s, they're crazy, right? We live in a different economy. And what it, you know, in the 90s, you had to mess up to lose, right? I mean, the economy was just booming so much. If you opened a store, you were successful. And today, you got to do everything right. And there's still no guarantee. Mm. And so you got to be willing to play and figure out what works and doesn't work and be just really conscious of your environment.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're getting to top of the hour. I see Julie back there.
Said enough.
All right. Well, I'd like to thank our
guest.
Yeah,
we could go on and on, but maybe the listeners right. had enough.
Oh, you know, maybe for another program, you know,
yeah,
2.0.
Oh, thank you.
2.0, absolutely.
Yeah. Come back. Bring your interns. I don't know. Do some.
Okay.
Yeah, and tonight
we're always open to ideas. You know, any kind of anything goes.
Yeah, and tonight we're having the
right
thing that you're going to be moderating.
Right, right. Maybe not. Yeah.
Yeah. He's on the panel.
He's going to be on the panel. And just say exactly what it is, so people that just tune in.
So the event is Money for Nothing: A Look Inside the Federal Reserve, and it's 7 p.m. over at the Bush Science Auditorium. Networking event is 5:30 to 6:30, and if you go to our website, 3P Business Consulting, you'll be able to get the agenda and all of the logistics. But Benny will be on the panel after the movie, and so hopefully we'll have a spirited conversation.
That's right,
uncensored. With the others.
Yeah. I have a Red Bull.
I won't have my hand on the dump button because there won't be one. But anyway, thank you for listening to Punkonomics here on WPRK Winter Park, Florida, the voice of Rollins College, and the best in basement radio. See you again next week from 2 to 4.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Song. Oops.
Is there
music.
An anarchistic and scholarly review of current local and world issues with Dr. Benjamin Ballack and Jesse Velez. Every Wednesday from 2 to 4 p.m. here on WPRK.
Information is free.
The law.
There is hope.
The preceding program did not reflect the views or opinions of this station, its management, or employees.
WPRK in Winter Park, Florida.
We are Lola B.
And I'm Candace B.
You're listening to WPRK in Winter Park, Florida. We are Queens of Noise. Queens of Noise.
Queens of Noise.
Queens of Noise.
Queens of Noise.
Queens of Noise.
I'm starting to dread the weekends because of my husband's drinking. He doesn't stop drinking until he's out of control and passes out. A counselor told me to try Al-Anon Family.